Great. Thank you, Your Honor. Ephraim McDowell on behalf of Petitioner Appellant Jason Sinano, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. In the district court, my client sought U visa certification under 8 U.S.C. 1184 P1 so that he could apply for a U visa from USCIS. In denying his request, the district court held that it lacked jurisdiction, both because it mistakenly believed that it was reviewing a USCIS denial of a U visa petition, and because it thought its certification authority was confined to criminal cases alone. The government primarily defends only the latter rationale, so I'd like to start there, beginning with the text of the relevant provision, and then moving on to the statutory context and the consequences of the parties' respective interpretations. So section 1184 P1 is set forth at page 3 of the addendum to our brief, and it states that certification can come from, quote, a federal, state, or local law enforcement official, prosecutor, judge, or other federal, state, or local authority investigating criminal activity, close quote.
Counsel, could your client have gone to the local sheriff and asked him to give a certification?
Yes, Your Honor, I think he could have done so. And this is
even if the local sheriff didn't have anything to do with the investigation?
Yes, Your Honor, I think that's what 1184 P1 contemplates. But let me point out a very important thing. That's not to say that any of these officials, whether it's a judge, a local prosecutor, or police officer, has any obligation to do anything when they receive such a request. 1184 P1 broadly.
Wait a minute, they don't have any obligation.
Just to be clear, it can be. He could go to the sheriff of the county where he's living, even or some other sheriff. It wouldn't even have to be a sheriff that was in the same circuit where he had been living.
Your Honor, that is the upshot of the statutory text. The statutory text broadly empowers...
Congress was so clumsy with this that they would allow him to go to any law enforcement officer in the country to seek a certification? He was cooperating in which they had no involvement?
There are a couple points I'd like to make about that. So, first of all, again, that interpretation would impose no additional burdens on those officials because they have no obligation to do anything with respect to the request. What 1184 P1 does is it broadly empowers those officials to provide certification.
But just to be clear, counsel, so your position is that this is an act of unreviewable discretion by the listed character, the judge, the law enforcement. So that's not something that you can challenge in the exercise of their discretion whether to act on it. Is that what you're saying?
In the mine run of cases, that's going to be the case. The reason why this decision below was different was because the court held as a matter of jurisdiction that it lacked power to provide certification in a civil case at all. And under this court's Section 1291 case law, that sort of jurisdictional holding is quintessentially judicial and makes it judicially reviewable.
Counsel, why is this? I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, but in the mine run denial on the merits or even where the request is not handled in any respect, there would be no appellate review under 1291.
Counsel, why is the certification request appropriately brought in habeas?
Your Honor, that's another point of confusion, I think, because my client's habeas claim was with respect to his due process claim.
So I just want to make sure. So you do not have a freestanding claim for certification that can be brought in habeas?
No, Your Honor. How we think 1184 P1 works is it essentially it's a statutory provision that empowers judges and these officials to provide a particular generally administrative remedy, just like the provision in Iestis v. Davis, for instance, allow judges to provide a funding remedy.
Let me ask you about that. Go ahead, Judge Bybee. Go ahead.
All right. I just want to follow up with that with two quick questions. So could he have brought a freestanding request, let's say citing 1331 federal question jurisdiction rather than habeas? As a cause of action, did he have a freestanding cause of action? If you just come in and said, the only thing I'm asking for is certification and I'm filing under 1184 P1 and 1331.
Your Honor, no. And the reason for that is that generally these are going to be administrative requests.
Okay. I understand that answer was very clear. Thank you. Now, given that he could not have brought a freestanding request, how can he attach it? Assuming that he had a due process claim. How could he attach it to a due process claim? What gives him the right to do this and then file an appeal from that if he couldn't have brought it as a freestanding action?
Okay, so as to the appellate jurisdiction point, this was an administrative request. And again, normally a denial on the merits of a request would not be appealable under 1291. for the reasons the government states it's an administrative request. The reason why he can appeal this decision is because the court held quite clearly throughout its decision that this was a jurisdictional holding. The court said it lacked
power. Sir McDowell, could I ask you a question about that?
Yes.
So let's say you file a habeas petition in my court and you've got a due process claim. And then you say, you know what, Judge, since I have you, as part of this habeas proceeding, I'm going to ask you to perform my wedding ceremony. And my response to you is, well, I appreciate the request, but I don't have jurisdiction to perform your wedding ceremony. And it turns out that I'm wrong about that. You're saying that because I declined to perform your wedding ceremony on jurisdictional grounds rather than on the merits, because I didn't think you were a good couple or whatever, you can appeal that to the Ninth Circuit.
No, Your Honor, because there's no statute governing when judges can provide wedding ceremonies. Then a helpful analogy here is the CJA.
Okay, what if there was?
Then it would just be like the Criminal Justice Act attorney fees context, where this court has held quite specifically that when a district court sets a fee rate on the merits, that's not reviewable. It's an administrative decision. But when a district court holds that it lacks jurisdiction to provide attorney's fees under the Criminal Justice Act statute at all, that becomes a reviewable decision. So assuming there were a statute concerning wedding ceremonies, then yes, I think that could be appealable. But obviously, I don't think that there is such a statute on the books. And just to be very clear again, the habeas petition under 2241 raised...
Counsel, it seems a little bit odd that, like, you know, so the judge says, I don't think, because after all, there is sort of a question here that we haven't really got to, the interpretation of statute of whether or not any judge can do this, or whether it needs to be judges involved with the case. So, you know, if a judge took, you know, interpreted that as a legal matter, just like we're going to have to probably address that question. If a judge took that and said, I wasn't involved with the case, so I don't think I was involved, so I don't have, I don't think I can do it. And the judge could answer that question in three ways. The judge could say, I'm not going to do it, just I'm not going to do it. And you wouldn't know. And I guess you would say that we don't have, that would not be appealable because you wouldn't know that the judge had decided that on a jurisdictional basis or just refusing to do it. Or the judge could say, I don't have jurisdiction, which is the other end of the spectrum. And you're saying that is just because the judge did it for that reason. And then the judge could say something sort of in the middle, like, I don't think this statute says I can do it. And I guess you would say that was lack of jurisdiction.
Well, it would depend on what the judge says in the case. And here the judge was quite clear throughout. The judge said that she lacks subject matter jurisdiction. On page 13, ER 13, the judge said the appropriate court to issue certification.
No, I get that. It's just the odd thing is you've got a judge that doesn't want to do this, right? And she doesn't want to do it because she doesn't think she has jurisdiction, which she may or may not. But if, at the end of the day, if we say, oh, it turns out you do have jurisdiction, I mean, she's not going to do it, right? It's just going to go, that seems much to do about nothing.
Well, the reason why it is important, Your Honor, is because judges in this circuit and elsewhere need to know, in our view, that they have the power to provide certification even outside of an ongoing criminal case. So this may
be and people in detention need to know they should send. I mean, under your interpretation of this, that they should send mass mailings out to every judge and law enforcement and local sheriff and see if they can get one to bite. Under your interpretation.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that's likely to occur for a couple of reasons. First,
you just send them all to San Francisco; they'll get granted.
First of all, Your Honor, there's little incentive for non-citizens to do that sort of thing because it's very unlikely that a judge is going to sign such a certification request under pain of perjury and say that the substantive certifications are met. And even in the off chance that a single judge here or there in San Francisco or wherever did so, USCIS would simply deny the U visa petition for a frivolous request, so that non-citizens would end up with no benefit anyway. And then on the other hand, these are non-citizens who.
So what you're saying is that the judges that are going to get these are judges that, like here, you have some other, and they bring it as a pendant action, so to speak. You're going to run out of time, and I'm curious about this due process claim, this amazing due process claim that that Mr. Nassanio brought. So, you know, I went back and looked at his, and of course he's a pro se. Petitioner, but he mentions, I think, as ground four, he mentions a due process. Not clear to me what that is. And if I was reading his, and as you know, he did in his remedy, he doesn't ask for any bond hearing or anything like that. His whole complaint, his whole petition, reads like it's all about, I can't get released earlier because I don't have this certification, so please give me the certification. And then the judge dismisses that without the government ever being involved. When he files a motion for reconsideration, he says, you didn't address some other ground, but he doesn't say what that ground is. Again, there's in fact, due process isn't even mentioned in the motion for reconsideration. And it isn't until I read in the reply that I actually would have, I as a judge would have any idea that he's talking about some due process claim that's unrelated to his U visa. So why, I understand we need to read things generously for pro se petitioners, but I don't think that extends to letting them raise an argument and actually articulate what it is for the first time in their reply in support of their motion for reconsideration. So I'm not sure there is actually a due process claim here that is independent in ground three, he mentions due process in service of his U visa. So what is that due process claim?
Well, even if there is no due process claim, this court still has jurisdiction to decide whether the court has power over the under the 1184P1 to provide certification outside of a criminal case. This court's appellate jurisdiction does not rest on the fact that he raised a due process claim. But putting that aside, as to the due process claim, we think that you do have to read it generously because it's a pro se petitioner. And number two, he's operating against the backdrop of precedent in the Ninth Circuit, such as Rodriguez v. Robbins, where courts are saying that after 6 months in detention, petitioners like him are owed a bond hearing and sometimes.
The bond hearing is the closest. That's what I wouldn't have known he was talking about a bond hearing until his motion in support of his reply in support of his motion. Well, that'd be the first I'd know that when I go and read it. And then I actually read the cases and go, oh, he's talking about a bond hearing. I didn't know that. So query whether or not he can bring that up that late, even as a pro se petitioner. But even if he could, that's mooted. I mean, he's got a bond hearing. He's out on bond. So I understand that some due process claims aren't mooted by release. A due process claim that my due process rights are being violated because I haven't been released through a bond hearing, that would seem to be mooted by a bond hearing. And
respectfully, Your Honor, Doof 2 and Rodriguez v. Hayes are both directly on point here, and they say that when a petitioner is released, who raises a prolonged detention claim asking for a bond hearing, is released during the pendency of the case, that does not moot the case so long as the government has disavowed legal authority to re-detain him without a bond hearing.
Did those cases involve somebody who was released after a bond hearing?
Your Honor, I don't believe so. But this is
if he's been released, if he's been released on bond, what's his claim to have another? He wants another bond hearing.
Your Honor, he could be re-detained without a bond hearing right now after Jennings.
Sure, but if he's but you but are you what you does he get bond hearings in perpetuity?
No, Your Honor, but he's saying that to be re-detained, he would need another bond hearing. Right now, the government could re-detain him without a bond hearing under Jennings v. Rodriguez. A declaratory judgment saying that that's impermissible would put him in a better position than he currently is in today. So that claim remains live. But again, nothing.
I think your problem on the mootness issue is that this was not a situation where a judge ruled in your client's favor on his request for a bond hearing, and then he got his bond hearing and he was released, and the government takes it up on appeal, and the government gets the district judge's decision reversed on appeal. I would think in that situation, you might have a concern, right, that based on the reversal, the government will go out and re-detain your client. But in this case, your client filed this petition. He lost in the district court, and ICE released him for some reason that's apparently unrelated to this lawsuit, and gave him a bond hearing for some reason that's apparently unrelated to this lawsuit. And so that, it seems to me, clearly moots the request for a bond hearing.
Your Honor, I take the point that the factual circumstances are different, but I think that's ultimately a distinction that doesn't make a difference, because what the question is whether there's voluntary cessation here, and the government has a very heavy burden to show that mootness through voluntary cessation. It would have to show that he has no continuing stake whatsoever, and a declaratory judgment that re-detaining him.
Counsel, I don't think that makes sense, because, you know, remember, we're pretending, we're in the slightly fantasy world that he actually had raised an argument. And as best as what I've heard from you is the only one I can think that he could have raised is, I want a bond hearing because I deserve one because of due process. He got that bond hearing. Now, if he gets brought back for some reason, he got that bond hearing and he got the remedy he wanted. If he gets brought back, maybe he'll have another due process claim, but it will be a different due process claim than the due process claim to say, I want that initial bond hearing. So it seems to me like it's completely not ripe and completely speculative as to whether or not he might get brought back. Unlike, as Judge Chhabria said, it'd be a different situation if the government was fighting him getting a bond hearing, but this isn't that situation.
Your Honor, again, the question would still be whether someone who is detained for the length of time that he was detained, which I believe was 22 months, could be re-detained without a bond hearing. And that would be essentially the same legal question of whether that he was raising initially, whether his due process rights would be violated by holding him for that amount of time without a bond hearing. And again, a declaratory judgment here that he could not be re-detained without such a hearing would put him in a better position. And that's all that is required.
Counsel, I don't know how he could have been raising the argument when he was detained. His argument when he was detained, best case scenario, is that I deserve due process, I deserve a bond hearing and to be released on bond. He got that. His argument could not have been, I don't think it passes a straight face test. His argument could have been, I deserve, if I get a bond hearing and I get released, to not be able to be re-detained without a subsequent bond hearing. That could not have been his argument that he brought in his petition.
The factual circumstance, I agree with that, but I do think that ultimately the legal claim is the same one, which is under what circumstances someone that's been detained with their asylum proceedings pending.
I mean, under your argument, just to be clear, under your argument, if you brought a due process claim and you said, I get a bond hearing, and the court says, you're right, your due process, I rule for you on your due process claim, you get a bond hearing. And your client could say, well, that's not, you haven't ruled for me because you haven't given me a due process claim saying I can't be taken back without a bond hearing. There's no end to that claim. There's no way to resolve it.
The difference here is that we're within the context of one case, and the question is whether there's mootness through voluntary cessation. And it's the government's burden to show that it's impossible, essentially, for my client to still have any modicum of relief. And I just don't think the government has made such a showing.
I'm sorry, I know we've taken you over, but I just thought of one other thing, one other problem with your mootness argument, which is my understanding. I had a case a couple of years ago called Saravia versus Sessions. And what I learned in that case is that, at least as of a couple of years ago, ICE's policy was, if you release somebody on bond and you want to re-detain them, you can't just go out and re-detain them. You have to show, ICE has to show, that there are changed circumstances from the time that an immigration judge determined that the person was neither a flight risk nor a danger to the community. So unless that policy has changed in the last couple of years, I think actually your client would have the opportunity to challenge his re-detention now that an immigration judge has released him on bond.
Well, the government has not made that representation here, so I guess I just encourage you to ask the government that question. My understanding is that the government is aggressively interpreting Jennings v. Rodriguez such that they could potentially re-detain my client without a bond hearing. But if they disavow that authority, then sure, that claim would be moot. But again, that is nothing. That's a completely separate question than the 1184 certification request, which I think is the kind of the principal question that's raised by this appeal and the ground on which the judge below decided the case.
Thank you, counsel. We'll go ahead and I'm sure we'll give you some time for rebuttal. We just want to make sure you're getting your time's worth as a pro bono counsel on this case.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Go ahead, counsel for the government. You can proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Francesca Genova with the Department of Justice, and I represent the Attorney General in this matter. As a preliminary matter with regard to the U visa certification, there is no claim, as the court has already pointed out, against the executive branch. The claim on the U visa certification is directed towards the district court and the district court's denial of that U visa certification. That was the gravamen of the habeas petition that was filed. And so there are two distinct issues in this case, if you even take it that he made a bond detention claim, which, as the government pointed out in the brief, it seems as if on the face of the habeas petition he did not. and that is the habeas petition and the U visa certification decision. There is no relation between a U visa certification and the habeas petition. It doesn't confer any benefits to get a certification that would permit any change in the habeas petition. In his argument, petitioner seems to now disavow the need for a nexus between the habeas petition and the U visa certification. However, it seemed as if in the brief that was the driving force of the court's jurisdictional determination and the error in that. In this case, the U visa certification decision, the district court was correct in denying, and the court could do so by determining that it lacked jurisdiction over the habeas claim. A U visa certification decision is issued in the same posture as if the judge is acting like a local, state, or federal law enforcement officer or prosecutor. And the form that is filled out for to receive a U visa certification states that under penalty of perjury, that you have to check a box about whether or not the person continues to be helpful in the investigation or prosecution of the underlying crime. So it makes sense that the court reviewing this determined that it was not a judicial type decision. So the language of jurisdiction doesn't really fit there. And
well, counsel, I get your argument on the fact that it did seem kind of odd to include, you know, every judge and every sheriff in the nation, right, as a possible when they have no tie to it. I guess in some sense, the question is, given the Sinus Council's position that it doesn't matter because they don't have, you know, they have pretty much unfettered discretion unless they accidentally make the mistake of saying they don't have jurisdiction. If they say that, then they're in trouble. But other than that, they have unfettered jurisdiction. What does it matter? I mean, I guess they can drop it in the circular file if they get one of these, it sounds like.
The issue with that is that that's not the correct reading of the statute. The statute makes clear that there needs to be a nexus, and petitioner's reading of the statute strips the cross-reference to the qualifying crimes from the provision stating that there needs to be a certification about those.
Okay. And the statute, so just to be clear, is your argument that the statute clearly says that? Because the statute's kind of confusing, and it seems to have two. That's the reason I had to get my reading law book out in order to compare these canons, and it seems like they go in opposite directions. So is your argument that it's clear that it has to have that nexus, or is your argument that is that it? Is that your argument? Or is it that we should defer to, under Chevron, we should defer to the agency's interpretation?
So our first line argument is that it is unambiguous that there needs to be that connecting nexus. The second argument is that it is ambiguous in terms of the term investigating and what Congress meant by that term, so that Chevron applies and the agency gets deference to the regulations.
It is kind of weird though, because judges don't investigate, right? So I understand that you've given an interpretation, but you're basically saying we should interpret it broadly, which is really saying we should interpret to mean something it is not really encompassed in the word investigation, I
think. USCIS made clear in its regulation that it noticed the tension how the word needed to be effectuated. But again, if you take a look at 1184 P1, which talks about the petitioning procedure, and then you look at the language of 1101 A15 U, lowercase Roman numeral 1, uppercase Roman numeral 3, you have almost the identical language talking about how the alien needs to be helpful or likely to be helpful to a federal, state, or local law enforcement official, to a federal, state, or local prosecutor, to a federal or state judge, to the service, or to other federal, state, or local authorities investigating or prosecuting criminal activity described in Clause 3. And petitioner, in his reply brief on page 20, does not contest that provision means that you have to be helpful to an organization dealing with the underlying criminal complaint. So the difference between those two statutes seems to be negligible, and USCIS, in interpreting the statute as a whole, looking at these statutory provisions, looking at the context and the purpose, which the Supreme Court has routinely upheld in determining the meaning of a statute, where in the public law when this was promulgated stated that the purpose of the U visa is to assist a law enforcement agency in the prosecution of crimes and to assist them in regularizing the aliens who assist in the prosecution of those crimes with the dual humanitarian purpose that it is good for the alien to receive a U visa based on this.
So I think I agree with your argument that you win on this statutory construction question at step one. I mean, it seems to me that when you look at the language and the context, there's only one reasonable construction, and that's yours. And if there's only one reasonable construction, that means you, I think that means you win at step one. But my question is, do we get there? Because you've also argued that it's not appealable. And as you've heard, that argument has gotten some traction. Does that sort of preclude us from construing in an opinion, if we agree with you on that? Does that preclude us from construing the statute in the way that you want us to, or is the statutory construction question still relevant in the context of whether it's appealable, whether this the judge's decision was appealable?
No, Your Honor, you wouldn't need to reach the statutory construction question if you rule on the 1291 issue. And there are two points to that 1291 issue. The first, as this court has held in re application for exemption, regarding PACER fees, is that the request is unrelated to pending litigation and that it is not an adversarial proceeding. That's the issue in this case because there is no complaint, as I mentioned, against the executive branch in this matter. So the executive branch is not an adversary. The presentation about the U visa is more...
Counsel, if that's right, I'm just thinking a little more about it. So Judge Chhabra, I think, asked a really good question. And if what you just said is the right answer, which maybe it is the right answer, but that means that you're never going to get appellate judges to say, to give the imprimatur to your interpretation, which would prevent this kind of thing in the future. So is that really what you want? Or would you rather have, if we were agree with you, would you rather have us say, this is, you know, the interpretation of this is it has to be somebody that was actually involved in the investigation for the crime?
Your Honor, it's not the case that it wouldn't be able to get reviewed if USCIS were to deny a U visa based on the fact that it did not believe that a certification from an unrelated entity was sufficient. Then that would be reviewable. This court recently held.
Do they do that? I don't know how USCIS does it. Do they? You know, we have in the briefing that basically they take the certification, but they exercise independent judgment. What do they say when they say no, or do they say anything? Do they just never hear back? What happens?
I'm not sure in every instance. However, I have seen lengthy opinions from USCIS about their rationale for ruling against a U visa certification, on which their forms of record for a court to review. So that would be the avenue for an ultimate review of this particular question. Right now, it's not an appropriate place for it because USCIS is not a party to this case. USCIS doesn't have any stake in whether or not this person receives a U visa certificate.
Counsel, if somebody just went to a judge independently outside of habeas or anything else and just said, would you sign the certification? The judge said no. They could file a mandamus petition with the Court of Appeals, couldn't they?
I don't believe that mandamus would be appropriate because I think a discretionary act does not qualify for mandamus.
Well, that would be a judgment by the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals would have a shot at that.
Yes, the executive branch doesn't have a position on how a federal court would handle that type of.
But that would be an alternate way of getting the question before a Court of Appeals.
Yes, Your Honor, if that's how your honors would accept a mandamus.
Unless the judges have more questions on this, you're running out of time a little bit, and the second issue, the whole the question of whether or not he brought a due process claim, and especially whether or not that due process claim, if it is in fact the detention, whether that's mooted by the fact that he's been released on, I'm sorry, if it was a request for bond hearing, if that's been mooted by the fact that he got one and got released. That's something that I'm really interested in.
Yes, Your Honor. As you had discussed earlier, from the face of the habeas petition, it does not appear that he actually did seek a prolonged detention habeas or file a prolonged detention habeas petition. Even assuming that he has been released on bond, and a prolonged detention habeas, the remedy for that is a bond hearing, not even necessarily release. He was released on bond pursuant to a Rodriguez bond hearing in December of 2018. Because he's a member of the Rodriguez class in the Central District of California. And so there's no argument that his release is in any way tied to this litigation. And there's no remedy to provide him. He's currently released on bond for an indefinite period of time while his immigration case proceeds. He has some requirements to check in and not to violate law, but there's been, he's otherwise, at liberty to be out on bond. And, when the government takes an alien back into custody, my understanding is that they do receive an initial custody redetermination hearing. So to the extent that there's this argument that, well, he now actually has a claim to a statement that he would be entitled to a bond hearing upon redetention. That's unripe because you don't have the situation where he's been taken into custody without a bond determination. So there is no relief that this court or the district court could provide on that claim, even if he had properly brought it. But as Your Honor had mentioned, it does appear that he didn't really bring that up. He didn't bring it up until his reply brief to the motion for reconsideration.
There's probably just more curiosity, but this whole, the whole underlying thing of his U visa is that he's going to help solve some crimes about where his identity was stolen. Do you know if any law enforcement or anybody has showed interest in that? In that particular thing?
That's not something that I'm aware of or the government is aware of. It may be something that his counsel would be aware of, having been in contact with him. But yes, the place for him to receive that U-Visa certification would be from the people to whom he complained. And so he also still has the ability to get a U-Visa certification potentially from those organizations or from those agencies, if those agencies decide that they would like to issue one, that they are doing an investigation. But that decision is unreviewable, and the decision of the court in this instance is also unreviewable because the court is situated in the exact same position as the other law enforcement agencies over which Congress could not provide a cause of action.
Thank you, counsel. Do you have anything else you want to present?
On the last point, in terms of the jurisdiction, the fact of the matter is that the district court did make merits rulings on what she perceived to be her grounds for denying the U visa certification. And the judge was proper and could, because she was the one who'd have to swear under penalty of perjury that she believed that he actually would be helpful or is likely to be helpful to a prosecution. So this court could even just make that factual determination if it did decide that it was reviewable. Again, the government contends that the first point that is not a reviewable case for controversy.
Thank you, counsel. Judges, do you have any other questions for this counsel? Mr. McDowell, I'll give you a couple minutes for rebuttal, but go ahead.
Okay, so I'd like to focus my rebuttal on the 1184P1 issue, and to begin with the text of that. To rule for the government, or even to say that the government has a reasonable interpretation, you'd have to say that judges investigate criminal activity. And that's just not a reasonable reading of 1184P1's text, not only because in our adversarial system, judges just don't do such a thing. They adjudicate cases that come before them.
What about when they do... I don't do this, but Judge Chabria, when they get a request for a warrant, I suppose you could characterize that as looking into whether or not the warrant has enough in order to provide the warrant. That And that's not actually a crazy thing, I don't think, because those would be the types of judges that you would say this person was particularly helpful in providing the information that formed the basis for the warrant. So it makes sense to ask that judge about that.
I guess I just don't think that that's a natural way of describing what a judge does, even in that context. I think we think of judges as adjudicating cases, not investigating cases. And Congress could have easily added the term adjudicating to the limiting clause here and made it.
Counsel, how about supervising a grand jury?
I don't think that the judge in that context is doing the investigating. And it's also, by that point, we're so far.
Well, the grand jury is doing the investigating, but the judge has some supervisory role.
Correct, but the statute simply says that the limiting clause is investigating criminal activity. So I think that signifies that the certifying entity has to be investigating criminal activity. And I just don't think that's a natural construction of the text. And then on the 1291 appellate jurisdiction point, the government relies principally on NRA application for exemption. But that case drew this distinction between jurisdictional decisions and merits decisions that I'm relying on here today. It said at page 1041 of the NRA Derrickson, which was a CJA attorney's fees case, was unique in that the lawyer sought to appeal from a district court's decision that it lacked jurisdiction under the CJA to award fees at all. That's precisely what we have here, because the district court below held that it lacked jurisdiction to provide U visa certification in civil cases at all.
So just to be clear, counsel, if I understand right, because you're saying as long as they don't say they didn't have jurisdiction, then it's unreviewable act of discretion. So if you don't answer at all, if you're a judge that gets one of these, and I guess it could be us, right? Any judge gets one of these and you just don't answer at all, that would not be reviewable. But if you answer and say, I don't think I have jurisdiction, that's reviewable?
Yes, Your Honor. And I don't think that's particularly odd when you look at the CJA attorney's fees context, because what the court was saying is certain times, in certain contexts, some decisions are administrative and others are judicial. It doesn't have to be one or the other. It's not an on or off switch. So when a court says courts generally lack this power, that is a judicial decision. And that's the sort of decision that the judge made below. And that's what makes it a judicial decision, and that's reviewable under 1291.
Thank you, counsel. Any other questions, judges? Well, thank you both for your argument, and this case will be submitted today.